One thing I want to touch on in this talk a little bit is a little bit about translational science. I'm going to use parent-child interaction therapy as an example of a translational effort. Translational science is sort of a buzzword these days, and basically it means two things. One is what people refer to as bench to bedside, which is laboratory to practice. But what I'm going to talk about is more the other part of what people sometimes call type 2 translational science, which is taking what we know and adapting it and moving it into actual field settings and potentially scaling it up. So I'm going to use PCIT as an example of this, hopefully you'll get some idea of how the process can work. Currently, I think where we are as a field and responding with interventions and services in child abuse and neglect is not that we need more and better interventions. We've got plenty, and you've heard about at least a couple of them here today. Our challenge now is taking what we have developed and translating it and moving it into field settings and scaling it up so that people get it in volume and that it makes population level impact. Not one child impact, but impact on an entire population. So having said that, I'm going to talk a little bit about behavioral parent training models. And there's a whole family of these things, which are sometimes called Parent Management Training Oregon or the Oregon model. Or have you ever heard of Constance Honf, who was sort of the mother of all, yeah, John has, the mother of these, who is a little known person who developed a lot of these kinds of models. This is Jerry Patterson and the late John Reed, who were in Oregon, who are kind of, in some ways, the fathers of all of this. Constance Hoffman, kind of the mother of all this. But there's a whole range of these things. PCIT is one. Triple P, which is out of Australia. Barclay's model for defiant teens. It's parenting a strong-willed child. The Forehand and McMahon model, which is out of Georgia. Incredible years, Carolyn Webster Stratton's out of the University of Washington. Folks, these things are like flavors of vanilla ice cream. You got home-style vanilla, you got French vanilla, you've got natural vanilla, vanilla bean vanilla, and all this, but you know, the content of them is virtually the same in terms of the parenting skills that they teach. Now, they differ in their delivery mechanism and the way delivery is approached. And the example I'm going to use is PCIT, which has a fairly unique delivery mechanism. But keep in mind that these things are all very similar in what they do, and they're going to overlap a lot with some of the parenting things you've heard about earlier. They were originally developed as treatments for disruptive behavior disorders or externalizing behavior problems in children. Here are the DSM criteria for that. I do want to thank my mom for taking one of these photographs. Those of you who are parents, you know this. Those of you who are young people, this is why you're thankful that family planning is included under the Affordable Care Act. So, what do they have in common? They're all based, essentially, currently the first line treatment for behavior problems in kids, all caregiver or parent mediated treatments. So they all change child behavior by changing parenting or caregiving behavior. Anytime you have a child with disruptive behavior problems and someone has them in the office with the sand tray, look for a different treatment. They are all parent mediated. They're skill focused. In other words, they focus on parenting as it is actively, behaviorally delivered in vivo, not as it is talked about or conceptualized after the fact. So in other words, we're not sitting around talking about parenting, we're doing parenting and directly as it is actively being delivered. They use a lot of modeling, a lot of behavioral practice, a lot of feedback. You're going to hear very similar themes when John Lutzker talks about safe care and other kinds of similar models like this. Like most evidence-based practices, in case you haven't picked up on this from Judy's presentation, Monica's and Tony's, the things that distinguish the current crop of evidence-based practice from usual care is that they favor depth and intensity and focus and structure over breadth and comprehensiveness. Comprehensiveness has been the watchword in clinical practice. What about this? What about this issue? What about this issue? What about this? Do we have to deal? This family has 85 problems. We need to deal with 85 different things. That is not what we do in evidence-based practice, and it is not what we do in behavioral parenting programs. They essentially pick very selective targets and focus on them with structure, depth, and intensity instead of trying to cover everything and maybe giving it 5 minutes. They're time limited. They tend to get down to business quickly. They get things done quickly. People do not believe that this is possible. When you talk to providers about implementing this, they will say you cannot treat child post-traumatic stress disorder in 16 sessions with TFCBT. And the answer is, well, yeah, but sometimes you can do it in 8. Or 4. I was in Eastern Europe talking to some psychoanalytic people. They were practically throwing things at me when I suggested that you could treat child post-traumatic stress disorder in 16 sessions with TFCBT. And now it's sort of looking like, well, you know, for a lot of kids, it's 8. For some kids, it's less. But they focus, they get down to business quickly. The main themes in these are consistency, relationship enhancement, increasing positive and pleasant parent-child interactions, and using a structured behavior management system. Folks, this ain't rocket science. It is more about what you don't do than it is about what you do do. And there's some related home-based models, and many of them are fairly strong. PCIT is a little different in its delivery system, not in terms of the content or the skills. It's different, it's dyadic, parent and child are together. These are young kids, by the way. Monica's talking about, 7 to 17, 5 to 17. This is more, you know, you're sort of 2 to 5 little kids. It's a well-established behavioral parent training for early behavior problems in kids, about 14 sessions, give or take. The mean effect size across 13 randomized trials is about 0.6 to 1.5. That's big. Anything over 0.8 is big. So it has big effects. The benefits generalize to school settings, and they generalize to untreated siblings in the same family. There have been several scale-ups. NCTSN, which you also heard about, is also disseminating and scaling up PCIT. By the way, there's, I think, how many, is Sarah here? How many agencies, Sarah, in Pennsylvania? Sarah has lost count of how many agencies in Pennsylvania are trying to scale up this particular model. But it's a lot. I think it's somewhere around 50, maybe, give or take. So there's active scale up of this model going on in your own state. It's two phases, like a lot of the HANF models are. The first phase is called CDI. It teaches positive parent-child relationship skills, use of praise, reflection, labeled praise, imitation, description, enthusiasm, avoiding criticism, comments. And then there's a discipline protocol that follows that particular phase, which focuses on using timeout with young children. Now, obviously don't use timeout with older kids, right? Timeout doesn't work with your 16-year-old. They don't want to be around you. So it only works, timeout is for younger kids. And strategies for managing challenging situations. So you see, this is a child behavior problem treatment. This is an example of the timeout, the behavior management protocol. It's not as complicated as it looks, and I'm not gonna go over it in a great deal of detail. So, why would anyone in their right mind pick a treatment for child behavior problems to use in child welfare? Well, when you think about it, this ain't the same thing at all. We're not focusing on getting kids to behave better. We're focusing on getting parents to behave better. So this was a rather radical adaptation of a lot of these models, moving from a minimal health clinic setting into child welfare service delivery and parenting setting. Any of you have familiarity working in child welfare? So this is an interesting, people outside child welfare don't know about you guys. It's an interesting little service system. It's actually not little. It serves millions of families a year in this country, are served through child welfare. And typically child welfare purchases services from community-based organizations, or they run them themselves, or they provide them through Medicaid. But it's an interesting service system. It is, in fact, foster care, for example, is one of the main gateways that children have into mental health care in this country. If you're in foster care, your odds of entering into services from a community-based organization or a formal mental health service organization are relatively high. So it is really a service system. It's not been studied a lot, but it's a service system that offers a lot of advantages for being able to deliver services to families and kids. It's not a service system that to date has had as much penetration of evidence-based services as a lot of other service systems, but we're getting there. So parenting programs really were one of long-time staples of child welfare service. The single most common service that child welfare refers families to is parenting programs. And typically these were parenting programs a la the 1960s. They were often sort of what people referred to as parenting classes. They involved getting a bunch of parents together in a group, getting butts in chairs, and talking about parenting, or more often than not, complaining about child welfare. It was kind of what happened in a lot of the services. And they really had not, by and large, this little service system, had not taken advantage of a lot of the developments in parenting programs that we saw with the more Oregon models and behavioral parent training models. So a lot of these parenting groups really were not particularly evidence-based. But there were a lot of similarities in that people began to notice, beginning with, I think, Anthony Urquiza and Cheryl McNeil is over in West Virginia. Can I mention West Virginia here?
Yeah.
Is that okay? I wasn't sure. You know, I knew in some parts of Pennsylvania it's not allowed to mention West Virginia. But Cheryl McNeil and Anthony Urquiza initially proposed this idea that fundamentally a lot of the processes in the etiology, the genesis of child behavior problems, and the genesis of physical abuse and neglect, which, by the way, physical abuse and neglect is 93% of child welfare. In case you didn't know, 80% of child welfare is neglect. But they noticed a lot of similarities in the genesis of these two problems in terms of parent-child interactions. And a lot of the things that the evidence-based behavioral parenting programs teach parents in an effort to reduce child misbehavior are also exactly the same changes that child welfare is looking for parents to make in terms of basic caregiving. So there were some fundamental similarities. This is a copy of the article that Anthony and Cheryl published on these names. I think it was back in 92, something like that. So it was quite a while back. So we began the process of adapting one of these models, PCIT, for parents in child welfare. And there were some major changes involved. So it's no longer a parent-mediated treatment. It is a treatment for parents. In fact, we got so tired of people talking about this as being a treatment for the child that we kind of overreacted the other way and said the child is simply a prop in this treatment. Now, that's not really true, because children benefit from this treatment too. But the main goal is improving parenting. We're looking for different outcomes. We're looking for child welfare recidivism reduction and less harsh and less disengaged parenting. So when I'm talking about disruptive parent-child interactions that often are at the core both of behavior problems and physical abuse and neglect, this is an example. This is from one of our randomized trials, and this is from the baseline data. So this is prior to any treatment. So we're basically looking at a sequential analysis of parent-child interactions. So a child does something, says something, and a parent responds. So we were looking here, for example, at when the child does something good, the child has an appropriate behavior, the child has a positive behavior. How does the parent tend to respond to that? And then how does a parent respond to a neutral behavior or to a negative child behavior? This is a negative parental response, a neutral and positive parental response. And you see that when the children were doing things relatively well, the parents were almost as likely to give a negative response as a positive one to an appropriate child behavior. This was that, again, at baseline. For an inappropriate child behavior, they were largely giving lots of attention and reinforcement inadvertently to inappropriate behavior, vastly more likely to give a more likely to respond positively to an inappropriate behavior than to an appropriate one. So if you're ever curious about the genesis of behavior problems among maltreated children, this may be a clue. We made a number of adaptations. And these are exactly the kinds of things that behavior parenting programs are designed to impact. So we made a number of adaptations. You may have noticed during Monica's presentation a lot of borrowing from motivational interviewing, the developing of discrepancy, the weighing of the pros and cons, other kinds of things like that. We did something similar in making an adaptation to parent-child interaction therapy for this purpose, simply because if you have a behavior disordered child and you're seeking clinical services, you're probably pretty motivated. I mean, after all, it's bad. But on the other hand, if you're referred by child welfare, you're not necessarily motivated. Now, one of the key differences between a lot of evidence-based practices and a lot of usual care services is usual care services, and particularly usual care parenting programs, can be passively consumed. All you have to do is have a butt in the chair and sit there and listen and occasionally talk about or volunteer on a team or something else like that. In evidence-based treatments, this is part of why the uptake of these is difficult. They demand a lot more activity from providers, they demand a lot more planning, and they demand a lot more out of clients. They often demand things like practice, demonstration of skills, homework, being able to modify behavior with feedback in vivo, a lot of other kinds. And so in other words, they take a certain amount of motivations because we had all worked in child welfare populations for a long time. We knew that people often arrive with various levels of motivation when they come in. Essentially, it's a coerced service system. So we added elements from motivational interviewing, and I'm going to show you a little bit about how that impacted the outcomes of the service a little later on. So, we also made a few other adaptations in terms of self-control. Again, fairly similar to AFCBT in some ways in terms of the self-control elements. Standard PCIT can involve the use of physical backups with children. We removed those for abusive parents. And we also extended it to age 12. Bear in mind, this is not a treatment for disruptive behavior disorder kids. In fact, most of the kids in the study did not have behavior problems. And we were focused mostly on the parenting skills. And we adapted elements from Barclay's Defiant Child model for the older kids. And these were some of the initial results that we found from this, just in terms of, this was, I think, a 2004 publication, and this is Survival for Future Physical Abuse Reports to Child Welfare, and we're comparing, this is a comparative outcome study, so there's two active treatments involved. This one was a protocol-driven parenting group that was based on something that's called Compassion Workshop, and also examining your own past and talking about your own past history of abuse and how that affects your current parenting. So, and you know, fairly typical curriculum-driven group parenting model that does not use behavioral parenting principles, and this was PC.
CIT, and we're tracking recidivism here at, I guess, about 900, up to about 900 days of follow-up, so 2.5, 3 years. And you can see that the recidivism for the PCIT group is really much, much better. It levels off here, never quite reaches 20% recidivism, whereas recidivism for the standard group reaches, it's better than 50-50. For those of you who are in child welfare, you know that 50% recidivism is not at all unusual in the child welfare system. Some folks out in Washington, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, did a cost-effectiveness, cost-benefit analysis on this. And this was the data from that study. So essentially, about almost $6 in benefits for every dollar of cost delivered. And these are short-term benefits, by the way. This is not long-term reductions in use of public services or incarceration or other kinds of things like that. This is child welfare recidivism benefits. So this is savings that the child welfare system might realize within a few years from lack of recidivism. So again, fairly favorable cost benefit figures. Some other findings, and I will plug a task force report that hopefully will be coming out within the next year that Monica is lead author on and I was involved in, which is called Evidence-Based Case Management in Child Welfare, and it elaborates on this theme a fair amount. And one of the findings in this study was that less is sometimes more. We had a third condition in this study where we essentially tried just to wrap services around families and just fill, you know, if they had a problem, we had a service for it, we provided it, we did it, and that included medication for depression, individual psychotherapy, family psychotherapy, marital therapy, on and on, individual therapy for all the kids, because we were sort of concerned parent therapy wouldn't be enough. Well, we did, in fact, succeed. Yes, we made them worse by adding all of these additional treatments. By the way, we later found out that when it comes to parenting programs, this replicated the findings of two meta-analyses that combined the data from a large number of studies. So this task force report, which should be coming out hopefully within the next year or so, Monica and I are involved in, essentially strives to set some new directions for child welfare, to steer services more in the direction of focus, structure, depth, and intensity, as opposed to comprehensiveness, which is, if you look at the federal guidelines, comprehensive is about every third word in a lot of these guidelines that they publish. So a lot of times what we saw, as we dug into this data, that there was less skill acquisition by parents when they were also receiving multiple other services. And this is, I think, a very well-intentioned and common effort that child welfare systems make to give people a service for everything because they really want to help. But I think what we're realizing in behavioral services is something that people in, well, they used to know in psychiatry, I don't know if they know it anymore, which is that seven different medications is not a good thing. People just don't always follow it. Yeah. So polytherapy is about the same thing as polypharmacy in that sense. We don't really know where the edges of the parameters are on this, by the way. We don't know how much is sufficient and where the curve begins to turn around and go back down in terms of loss of efficacy. But we did demonstrate it in this particular study. It's becoming a cross-cutting theme. Again, if you compare the current crop evidence-based treatments, including the ones you've heard about here today, you see that they get down to business quickly, they get things done quickly. Most change occurs in the first few sessions. This is a repetitive finding. They do fewer things, and they spend much less time gathering information and building relationships, and much more time on action and doing, and much more focused on skills and behavior, and they typically have a plan. Some sort. As opposed to what, and I'll refer you to Ann Garland's work if you're interested in this, Unusual Care, which is usually of unspecified duration, lots of relationship building, lots of focus on issues. If you actually look at videotapes of most child and family services sessions,
the most common thing people are spending time doing is gathering information, and in a much more free flow. So this is an example from our PCIT research. These again are trajectories for sequential parent-child interactions. And you see essentially that by about session 4 or 5, you've seen some really radical improvement in reduction in negative behaviors and increase in positive parental responses to an appropriate behavior. And these are families who had, on average, about 4 prior child welfare referrals. These were not the cream of the crop families. These families had high incidence of parental depression, substance abuse, 3 or 4 prior referrals into child welfare. And the response tends to be relatively rapid. So we did a second trial, essentially dismantling the motivational interviewing and behavioral parenting programs. And we also did the second trial, wanting to see if the results would hold when we took this outside of a university setting, rolled it out into a real-world agency setting. And we essentially replicated the results. And this was, again, 85%, about 15% recidivism versus about 60% recidivism in that study. So, by the way, these are meaningful differences, 15%, and you were hearing earlier, in under 10% recidivism versus 30, here we're showing 15% recidivism versus 60. So these are significant effects. These are not small effects. Our third trial essentially was a quality control trial. We're looking at how do you roll these models out at scale, maintain their quality, and maintain their benefits. So this was a study that was done in 2 states, Washington State and Oklahoma. And this shows the pattern of how things were rolled out over time, beginning with all the therapists at these agencies. There were about, 75 therapists or so. Got telephone supervision after their training. They got a telephone consultant. They were on these group telephone calls versus they got a live video feed where the consultant would do a direct observation of their practice about once every 2 weeks and give them active feedback on that. And we compared how this would impact not just their fidelity, but the client outcomes that they got. So here's an example. Here's a picture of it. So we have a remote consultant who's off here with a video feed talking directly to the therapist and able via camera to observe the parent and child together as they interact. And we got some interesting findings with this. One is these are behavior problem trajectories. This is the clinical cutoff for having a behavior disorder. So you see kids started off way up here. Yeah, they say these kids had plenty of behavior problems. And with the video consultation over time, they reached the clinical cutoff by about session 5. Now, this is a 16-session therapy, but frankly, what we're learning about evidence-based practices is a lot of kids are early responders. People are skeptical you can deal with things in 16 sessions. Now we're saying, well, maybe 8, maybe 5. We don't know. It varies by the kid. So it's about a 2-session. These are the kids that got, these are the therapists that got a telephone. So about a 2-session difference in terms of reaching clinical criteria. On a cost basis, the additional cost of the video technology was about saved by the 2-session less requirement to reach clinical criteria. So when we're talking about translating these evidence-based models into child welfare settings, what's the difference they can make in terms of bottom-line outcomes in child welfare? And the answer is, it is surprisingly large. So these are several studies. This is our 1994 study. So we're reducing recidivism from over 50 to under 20. That's a big reduction. These were a similar parenting program, except these were even more severe parents. These were parents, 80% of whom had all their children removed into foster care. 20% were facing termination of parental rights, which is 10 times the base rate in child welfare. They had, on average, 6 prior referrals, and this was their 7th trip through child welfare. And again, we're from 60% to about 15%.
This is comparing two home-intensive home-based service models where the only thing we changed was we changed the parenting curriculum from a standard one to safe care. You see a substantial reduction in recidivism. This is a foster care program where we did behavioral parent training with foster parents. And Patty Chamberlain reduced foster care disruption from over 30% to a little bit over 10%. These are meaningful child welfare, public policy relevant outcomes. So by translating these types of models into active care settings, we can make some fairly substantial benefits. One last point, and you've heard this before, you see improvements in parenting with TFCBT, and certainly with AFCBT, you see improvements in both child problems and parenting problems. But even with behavioral parenting programs, you began to see parent improvements and also improvements in child trauma-related symptoms. So basically, there is to a certain extent a rising tide lifting multiple boats with a lot of these types of treatments. So again, I think our main challenges in these areas are how do we take what we know about what is effective, move it into the field, keep the quality high, and keep the quality controlled so that we can deliver it at volume and begin to make population-level impact. So hopefully this has been a little information about how that can be accomplished.